Thank you for joining us on our journey here to preserve the history of mixed martial arts. When I wanted to take on this project, I needed help. I brought in one of my favorite matchmakers, Miguel Iturralde, and the MMA detective, Mike Davis. So to do this, we've been able to preserve history. Welcome and enjoy.
Lights Out Podcast, we've got a very special guest. We've got Draculino. What's happening, bro? Thank you for coming on the podcast, man.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Amazing. Your show is amazing, and I'm excited to be part of it.
Good. So, Draculino, as everybody knows, you are one of the original Gracie Baja members. You also were in several different instances in your career. You were involved in pivotal moments. Gracie Fusion, we're going to address all of that. The Gracie Fusion team is something that I don't think it's talked about enough, but we're going to start with your background. Why don't you tell us about your childhood and your immersion into jiu-jitsu?
Well, man, like almost every kid in Brazil, every boy in Brazil, my first martial arts exposure was to judo. So when I was like around 5, 6, I trained judo up to 10 years old. I got my yellow belt, actually competed in judo. And like I said, like, believe it or not, especially in the 80s, like actually 70s, it was the 70s, judo was like pretty much the only martial art that kids would train. You couldn't understand.
Is it George Medi?
Medi? No, that wasn't Medi. No.
Okay,
no.
No.
Okay. But he was super famous already.
Yes.
Same Medi. Yes, he was super famous.
Okay.
He used to teach in Ipanema. Ipanema is like a very wealthy a part of the South Zone of Rio, and he was always like a legendary master, very well known also for his toughness with the students.
Yes.
And
Mario Sperry, Babalu, or a lot of people went there.
A lot of people went there. But no, my lineage in judo was a little bit different. I went to Fenelon, Master Fenelon. He actually passed away a couple of years ago. And but believe it or not, judo wasn't what took me to jiu-jitsu, because after judo, I started to surf. And through surfing, I got to be really good friends of a lot of the Gracie family members. The surf spot that I was surfing was the same one. I was pretty much neighbors of Hanzo, Ralph, High, and Gracie. And a lot of the guys that everybody knows are the old guard right now, we used to be friends and hang out and surf together. Roberto Gordo, Alexander Soca, and Daniel Gracie, Carlos Russo, all these people, we're all friends, childhood friends, surfing in this place called Quebra Mar in Rio de Janeiro. So the Gracies were there. And then the first Gracie Academy opened in Baja. And, you know, one thing led to the other. You know what I mean? Like, we saw Hanzo, like a very skinny kid. He was older than us a little bit, but I remember Hanzo on the beach fights, skinny guy beating everybody up. It's like, man, I need to learn this.
Well, you know, speaking of beach fights, and you talked about your lineage, obviously, is incredibly impressive. Were you at the Hugo Duarte Hickson beach fight?
I wasn't, man. And guess what, Chris? Check that out.
Mike.
It was right. Oh, sorry, Mike.
It's okay.
It was in front of my house. I used to live by the beach, right in front of the place that the thing went down. But guess what? It was the first time that I went to America, me and my brother, to study English. I was in America and I missed it.
That's a good alibi. I wasn't even in the country.
Unbelievable, Mike.
Unbelievable. Wow. And it's broken down to me was that oftentimes, like, jiu-jitsu was with the gi. It was very expensive.
Yes.
And the luta libre was for the poor kids that did the jiu-jitsu moves just without the gi. Is that how you would describe it back then?
I think, Mike, I think this is a too much of a simplistic way to put that situation. I mean, like I said, man, I was lucky enough to have lived this. Nobody told me that. I was there. So I was like living on the peak times of the rivalry between us and the Luta Livre guys. I really think that, yes, Luta Livre had like a good portion of its tribe, I call their tribe, of like people from the favelas, some guys from the favelas with less means economically, But there was a lot of kids like us there too, middle class kids. And I think it was more, honestly, man, something kind of like people had like, you know what, man, jiu-jitsu, Gracie jiu-jitsu is the grain. Maybe go against the grain. If you want to go against the grain, what do? Luta livre. So a lot of the people to be kind of more on that like challenging vibe of that kind of like, I'm not going to abide by this kind of thing. I think there was more something to do with that. You know, Mike, I don't really think that's necessarily need to be in regards to anything economic. It was just a choice, you know? And man, like, guess what? They're as tough as we were. There were not many of them. Like, jiu-jitsu was always way bigger than Luta Livre. That's the truth. But those guys are vicious, man. Yeah. They were tough. Yeah. They loved their flag. You know, nowadays I get along extremely well with people that I used to hate back in the day, that used to get like in problems all the time. Like Master Hugo Duarte. Hugo Duarte, man. Hugo Duarte, like when I was a teenager, man, him and Angelo Tadeo almost beat me and Soccer up. They actually talked, you know, shit to us in a nightclub and tried to get our shirts. We had jiu-jitsu, Gracie jiu-jitsu shirts.
No.
You know, and we kind of like, we're terrified because they were older and bigger than us and vicious. But you couldn't show weakness, you know? So it's a lot of these situations with them. And nowadays, man, like I see them more and more. It was just the two sides of the same coin. They were just like us, but on the other side. You know what I mean?
And furthermore, once jiu-jitsu expanded, like you guys are cousins that like to fight. And then when you guys come to America, you find another cousin that likes to fight. That's the American wrestler.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't compare in a way that, don't get me wrong, like our rivalry with Luta Livre was actually criminal.
Oh.
You know? Yeah. It was a little, I'm not going to lie, man. It was a little bit of a gang thing. You know, there was shots fired. There was stabbing. There was like people like jumping, like 3-4 jumping in one. And a lot of street fights. A lot of street fights. So the thing was a little more, I would say criminal is a little too much, but a little more serious than the rivalry with wrestling. I think what happened in wrestling was that like we jiu-jitsu guys, we really recognized there was a huge force that we needed to adapt big time if we wanted to survive, you know, because the Luta Livre guys were good in takedowns. They defended takedowns well. We did as well. But man, like when you come, you guys, American wrestlers, taking us down, like without us even knowing what was going on, that changed things. So I think it was kind of more like our rivalry between jiu-jitsu versus wrestling was kind of more like on a technical part of it. You know what I mean?
So I had Mark Schultz on, who
amazing guy,
Pedro Sauer black belt, and he said because he was a rule book reader, not a rule follower. It's just here's the rules. How can I get around it? How can I, you know, escape what it is that they're trying, like an attorney? And in essence, he said, well, once I did one jiu-jitsu class, I open up the wrestling book and I look at the illegal moves. And in drawings is how you can learn jiu-jitsu. Basic jiu-jitsu.
Oh, wow.
And it's,
you see that?
There's some truth. There's math and then jiu-jitsu is the algebra. It's just
man, exactly. I agree. And I think like all the grappling arts, man, at the end of the day, come back to the same source. A lot of people say that wrestling, like back in old Greek times or whatever, was the very first grappling art way before judo, way before like jiu-jitsu and all that. I'm not really sure, but I know that they're all connected somehow, 100%.
Well, if you look at history of wrestling, and you said jiu-jitsu adapted because there was a force there.
Yes.
You have to look at Holes Gracie. Mm-hmm. He had the foresight to bring over Olympic coach.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
Uh-huh. Bob Anderson. Yes, sir. When was it? Was it like in the 70s, right?
It was. He brings in Bob Anderson. The Americana is born.
Yeah.
And you guys get your first taste of an American wrestler. Were you there at that point?
No, I was too young, Mike. I was, when that happened, I wasn't even trained in jiu-jitsu. I was in judo, you know. But I remember, because I was always from the South Zone of Rio, which is where the Gracies were, started the whole phenomenon. Sure. Whole phenomenon was on the South part of Rio, Zona Sul, we call. And I remember hearing about, oh, man, Halls brought this up. I remember people saying, this giant American guy. Yeah, I remember people saying, man, this gringo, man, this giant gringo, like from Olympic wrestling. Yeah. And man, this guy is huge. And I remember hearing like tales about that. Oh man, I host to meet him, but they said like this guy, nobody could take him down. I remember like when I was a kid, I remember this rumor, people saying these rumors, but I wasn't like, I didn't, you know, I wasn't close enough yet to realize that. But from a lot of sources, including my master, Master Carlos Gracie Jr., man, like Bob Anderson was pivotal for also our change in jiu-jitsu, because on the stand-up game that we have before Halls bringing Bob Anderson, it was almost 100% judo. We didn't see many leg grabs. We didn't see single legs, zero. Double legs, almost never. It was a lot of like hip throws, foot sweeps. It was very like, even with the way they fought, used to be like the judo guys, very like erect, grab you on the gi. Exactly. Because nobody cared about grabbing the legs. So nobody was kind of like needing, even worrying about it. And after Bob Anderson Hall's fusion, I would say everything changed. The modern stand-up game in jiu-jitsu came from that time, 100%, you know?
Okay. Well, at that point, as to where it is today, it's a much different animal. How would you compare what's going on today as to what you learned, like, in the beginning?
Man, like, I believe, like, every art and every sport evolves. You know what, Mike? I'm not one of those guys that said, oh, back in my day was way better. Oh, back in my day, people fought to submit only. Nowadays, people just stall and do like, oh, whatever. I'm not on those guys. I mean, I think the sport evolved like every other sport, and that's the truth. You know, I think it was a natural technical evolution that happens to everything. If you watch judo matches back in the day and judo matches now, they're completely different too.
Yeah.
Wrestling matches as well. Like, it was just a regular evolution of the sport. One thing that I'm not going to lie to you, one thing that bothers me a little bit, you know, and I'm not going to lie to you, is that I think that the modern times, we started to get too far away from the practicability on real combat. You know, like some of the techniques that are applied today are simply cannot relate at all.
No.
And I get it. I mean, you're not going to make like a grappling match or a jiu-jitsu with the gi match 100% only kind of like self-defense bulletproof. I get that. It's a different thing. You have to adapt a little bit, of course, like in wrestling too. But things that are kind of like too many flying things, like this inversion that people do and get underneath and get there like with their back smashed and the neck twisted and getting there. This, what's the name of that thing? That donkey guard. But that donkey guard is something ridiculous, disrespectful. People turn the ass to the other one and goes like this.
Oh, man. That's
what the heck is that? You know, this is like dishonorable.
You can't do that in prison. You can't use that in jail.
That's exactly. Let's put it this way. You know, so this bothers me, you know, and I, If you want to ask me like a solution for that, that's a tough solution. I think that you don't want to block the technical evolution, but also you want to find like a way to get the rules of the sport and make sure that you don't deviate too much from that. Because we saw other martial arts what happened, right?
You can look at boxing in the Olympics in the 80s and 90s, boxing was scoring, traditional scoring. And then in the early 2000s, they switched to point fighting.
Yes.
To pretend boxing in the 2000s during a point fighting era had anything to do with boxing is foolish. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's a different sport.
Yeah.
You know, totally. And I agree with you 100%. I mean, you see taekwondo. Taekwondo used to have, like, people used to fight taekwondo with their hands up. Kind of like more realistic. Sure. Now they fight like this. They just bounce around with their hands down. You know, because the rules are 100% for points. You know, so it took away 100% of anything that has to do with martial arts.
Self-defense. Yeah.
And that is a little dangerous, if you ask me. You know, I think it's difficult. It's very difficult. But I think when you start to deviate too much, you have to rethink things, you know?
Okay. So before your entire life got sucked into the world of jiu-jitsu, you graduated with a law degree from Federal University.
Yes, sir. I did.
How pissed was your parents when you decided to leave law and go into jiu-jitsu full time?
Are you ready to get your mind blown? Let me tell you. Let me tell you now. My father's a doctor, medical doctor. My mom is a lawyer. My father told me one day like this. He gave me a ride because I was doing internship in the biggest oil company of Brazil. It's called Petrobras. It's like a huge, probably the biggest Brazilian company till today. I was doing internship there. I did internship that 2 years. So I was to go to a law school and then go there and work from 1 to 5, from Monday to Friday. And this day I got a ride with my dad because my dad had to be in downtown Rio, and I got a ride with him. And I remember I was just like in the car, like putting my tie on and, you know, all like I was a little late and getting my papers and getting my things and going this. And then like he dropped me right in front of Petrobras, and I left the car and I say, okay, thank you, Dad. Bye, love you. And I crossed the road and I went to work. The same day, my father called me at night when I was home already. And he said, son, I was looking at you at the car, and I looked at you crossing the street to go to the office. And I thought to myself, this is not you. That's not for you.
No.
Telling you, it's not for you. Because my father used to go to all my jiu-jitsu matches, from the blue to the black. My father was there when I broke my leg in pieces in a world championship that I, you know, the mat kind of opened and I destroyed my leg and I had to do a major surgery. My dad was in every match on my, almost every match on my, all belts from blue to black. And he just didn't go to the Vale Tudo MMA fights because he said, I know this is too much, son. I mean, jiu-jitsu, I can do it, but MMA and Vale Tudo, I don't want to be there. You know, but he told me, that's your life. I mean, this is what you're born to do. Believe it or not. And my mom, at the same time, my mom told me, do what your heart tells you, because I know you're going to be great in what you do, no matter what. So believe it or not, my parents were the best. I'm giving
that's incredible. That is 95% of parents would not say that.
100%. 100%. And I wouldn't blame people like that, Mike. I wouldn't, because I mean, your son, one of the best law schools in the country. I did good in the law school. I mean, I was never a dumb guy. But I get it, man. I mean, if they said otherwise, I wouldn't be surprised. I would respect them the same way. But I'm telling you the truth. They said otherwise, and here I am.
when Pedro Sauer left the law, did he have a conversation with you as well about that?
Not Pedro. I didn't talk to him. I know he's an attorney too. But it's one interesting fact. The same law school that I graduated, Jorge and Gracie graduated there too. But years before. You know, and I remember a lot of the teachers that I had, a lot of the professors at law school, they knew I was a jiu-jitsu guy because I was a competitor. And a lot of times I have to ask them to do tests in other time because of I had like to travel for competition and all that. So they knew I was a jiu-jitsu guy. And maybe three or four of them was like, oh, do you know like this Gracie family member? call you and say, yeah, of course. Yeah, he used to be my student. He was just like you. He was always asking for a leeway and do the test in other dates. So he said like he did exactly the same thing. But another guy who actually graduated in law at the same university was Master Carlos Machado as well. So jiu-jitsu guys that I know, like famous guys, was Horion and Carlos as well on the same
law school. Liborio worked for a big bank.
Liborio was an economist. He wasn't a lawyer, but he worked for Banco do Brasil. He had actually a public job. In Brazil, when you have a public job, you can never get fired. You only get fired if you kill somebody.
But you
never get fired. So he had one of those jobs, a job that everybody would kill and die for, and he walked away too.
That's fantastic.
Liborio did that.
I mean, all of you guys took risks. Like, you can't achieve greatness without taking a risk.
100%.
Sometimes even being wrong. Sometimes you're going to be wrong, but
100%.
You can't get there without a risk, man. Let's talk old school history. So, Jiu-Jitsu, Luta Libre, big rivalry, obviously. And there was a video guy, Paquetao, obviously.
Paquetao, God bless his soul. Great guy.
That's what you say. Everybody on both sides of the argument say that. So we've had Luta Libre guys on, like we've had Pedro Rizzo, we got Babalu right now.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was both. Both of those guys say the same thing. So you've got two gangs very angry with each other, even fighting in the street, and both saying, no, the guy that records everything is okay. How is he able to manage that?
Man, Paquetá was a beautiful soul. I actually went several times to his house because he used to do video cassettes, tapes. And he used to record a lot of the fights from the tournaments for each person. So, I mean, I had mine. He had fights from me from the purple and brown belts. So he used to go to his house and he used to prepare. And he used to be there like the whole afternoon, hours and hours, like chit-chatting and talking. He was an amazing soul, an amazing guy. And I don't think it was only Paquetá, Mike. I think it's because Paquetá and Carson Gracie were best friends. And man, believe it or not, Carson, even though he was like the chief of the gang, let's put it this way.
I'm okay with that. Yeah.
You know, and he had the ultimate respect and he had completely access to all the Luta Libre guys as well. You know, it was a little different than other Gracies. And Paquetá and Carson were like that. They're always together. So I think Paquetá's, besides him being like the pretty much the only filmmaker of fighting back in the day, he was also so close to Carson that people gave him already automatically that kind of respect. You know what I mean?
And Carlson Gracie is one of my heroes. He's phenomenal. When you take people from the street with no expectations of jiu-jitsu becoming what it is and giving your time and care, brother, like the movies are made about people like that.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw that, but there's a book that just came out from Robert Drysdale. The second part, you're the second person
to recommend that to me, by the way.
Yeah, it's a really, I'm starting the book now. The book is really good. And the book is pretty much centered around Carson and my master, Carlos Gracie Jr. Because in his view, and I believe he's 100% right on that, both, especially Carson, did not get the recognition they deserved. They were the real ones that took the jiu-jitsu to heights that were never gotten before. In Carson more on the MMA side and Carlinhos more on the sports side of this. But they're both not even important. I think they were essential. That's the word. It's essential. And a lot of the story is told kind of like, I don't think it's for purpose, Mike, but man, almost nobody talks about them like the way they should.
No. Okay.
It's a lot about with all credit, Grandmaster Carlos, Grandmaster Elio, pivotal figures. Without them, we wouldn't be talking now, of course. And a lot about Hicks and a lot about Royce. They're also two phenomenal guys, amazing. But, man, Carson and Carlinhos, man, they should be. I mean, I think that Carlos and Helio are on the pedestal that nobody can touch them. And right before, right under him, under them, has to be Carson. Has to be. Carson is right there. And then we come Carlinhos pivotal, Hickson pivotal, Royce pivotal. You know, but man, like you cannot, nobody, I think this book was amazing because of that, because it will show the importance of Carson. Carson was a very simplistic guy. He wasn't like a guy who cared about being on the limelight. He didn't care about money, actually. He was completely selfless. You would give him like $1 million. He would spend $1 million in 1 week because he would buy everybody dinner. He would give a lot of gifts to beautiful women. He would buy like probably like 1,000 vinyls of French music. And then all of a sudden he didn't have any money anymore. You know, he was like that. He was like that, you know?
So I do commentary for Anthony Pettis Fighting Championship, which is on UFC Fight Pass. I go out of my way to drop Carlson Gracie stories. I have to. Every single event, I've got one coming up on Sunday. You will hear me drop Carlson Gracie.
That's great. That's great. He deserves, man. He deserves. Me, myself, even though like the rivalry between Gracie Barra, our team, and Carlson in jiu-jitsu, don't get me wrong, when it was us jiu-jitsu against Luta Livre, we're all together. But within jiu-jitsu, there was a big rival.
Okay, that's my question.
Yeah.
You know what? Carlson used to train his fighters to specifically, like, he would target his own family members, like Waleed Ismail, De La Riva.
Yes, yes. Man, honestly, let me tell you something that I really believe in my heart. That's the real case about that. Because I lived it, like I said. I mean,
sure, of course.
I competed against Carson guys since I was a teenager. There was no tournament that I fought, and I fought several. I lost count of how many jiu-jitsu matches I had. Every single tournament, there was a Carson guy. I competed against the Carson guys all my life, from before the blue belt all the way to the black belt. Gi, no gi, everything. Okay. And it was always a fierce competition. Against the guys, but I don't necessarily think that Carson was training his guys to beat the Gracie family. Carson was training his guys to beat the world. He was extremely competitive. So he never understood like, oh, okay, I cannot, when my students fight a Gracie family member, they have to withdraw, they have to lose. He never crossed his mind. He said, no way, man. This is my student. I'm going to train to beat them or anybody else that stays in front of them. What is the problem on that? You know what I mean?
Draculino, if you want the sport to advance,
yes,
then you have to be better.
Yeah.
And if I don't make this person better, you will never get better.
Exactly. And he had that vision. And, I mean, a lot of the people from the Gracie family, actually, he was on the category of being the black sheep of the family. You know that. It's on the big scheme of things. Oh, Carson was the first black sheep of the Gracie family.
If you don't think Carlson got into a couple fist fights at his family parties, you don't know the Gracie family.
It had to have happened. And if it didn't, I would be upset. Carson was just an extremely competitive guy. A beautiful soul, a simple guy, but Carson didn't want to lose, not even in a rock, paper, scissors. If there was going rock, paper, scissors to you, he would do whatever it takes to beat you. And if he didn't, he would keep trying until he beat you more and say, okay, now we're square. He was that kind of guy. He was just very competitive. You know?
He passed here in Chicago. And the jiu-jitsu community here in Chicago, the people like Jeff Neal, Stefan Bonner, Miguel Torres.
Miguel, yes.
He... when Brazil was the king of fighting, he would make public statements stating Miguel Torres would beat anybody in the entire world, including the country Brazil. He would make statements like that. And
I remember that.
24/7, somebody was by his side in the hospital. He was never alone.
That's good, man, because I honestly think that one of the reasons for Carson's health to deteriorate was a broken heart, man. I really think. Because of the whole thing that went down with the Brazilian tip-top team.
Yeah.
And I mean, I get it, man. I hear the stories, and I wasn't a direct student. I know them all, you know, forever. Some of them are really close friends of mine to these days. Everybody has its reasons. I get it. We're not going to go into details on that. But at the end of the day, I think that poor Carson, man, he never got over the broken heart that what happened to him. And I think, I really think that this contributed to poor guy, you know, for his health, you know, because he's such a big heart. He was such a genuine guy that like he could never imagine that something like that would happen to him. You know, it was pretty sad.
Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about 1995 Pan Ams. Fernando Yamazaki. I apologize.
No problem.
After that,
I called you Chris, man. You said no, Yamakazi. Okay,
right, right. Good. We're good.
You know?
In that match, afterward, you received your black belt from Carlos.
No, I was already a black belt then, Mike.
Okay.
Yes, in 95, it was my first black belt match, actually.
Okay.
I got my black belt I got my black belt in January 1995. I believe the Pan Ams was maybe June. Maybe June 1995 or something. I remember it was summertime in America. But yeah, it was my first match. My first black belt match.
How nervous were you going into that?
Let me tell you one thing, man. I really don't believe anybody who tells you that they never got nervous to get in a jiu-jitsu match or a MMA match or a Vale Tudo match or a grappling match. It's bullshit. Everybody gets a little bit of nerves.
You have to be.
In every single match of mine, I was a little bit nervous. But it wasn't anything huge on that specific match. Because I remember I went one weight class above. Yamazaki was heavier than me. I was a light featherweight, and he was a lightweight. So it was two weight classes above.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so when I went there, like I thought like my game would fit really well with him because he was really good judo guy and really good on top. And I knew I had absolutely zero chance of taking him down. Zero. And I was always really good. My guard was really, really good, especially back in the day when my back was still good. And then I said, you know what, man? I'm just going to pull this guy to my guard. Eventually, he's going to get tired. I'm going to sweep him, and I'm going to do my thing. That's exactly what happened. So I think the game fit well with mine, so it was good.
February 24th, 1999, you competed in Abu Dhabi.
Yes,
How did you get the invite?
That was a funny thing because in 1998, they had the first edition. But almost nobody talks about that one because it was something that they made like very in a quick way. There was something kind of like an experiment. There was only 8 people in each bracket. There wasn't 16 like it is right now. And it just happened. I mean, I heard about this thing because Soka, my great friend of mine, was invited to go because Soka actually taught some classes to Sheikh Tahnoum. To the Sheikh there. So he remember about Soka and invited Soka. And I knew about that, but we didn't really know what was going on. It's like, what is it? It's kind of like a Luta Livre event. We're just used to do gi. Is that like MMA? I remember some rumors, I think you can slap in the face and stuff like that. And then like when Soka came back, he won. It's like, man, it was amazing. It was like, this in a palace was great, blah, blah, blah. So everybody started to talk about it, you know? Yeah. And then in 1998, I made the finals of the world championships against Hoyler. And it was a very close fight. Ugh. A lot of people talked about that. It was really back and forth, this one in 1998. And
Hoyler's the man. Hoyler's the man.
Hoyler's a man. Yeah. Hoyler beat me three times.
Yeah.
Well, shit. He was the only one that I fought that I never beat.
he beat a lot of people a lot of times. So go ahead. I apologize.
Just put it this way. He beat four generations. Four. Four. Yeah. Because Hoyler was a black belt. I was a white belt. You know, so the guy, it's very hard to compare records, but I think that Hoyler has to be for sure top three in the whole history of jiu-jitsu competition, for sure.
100%. I mean, he went undefeated for years.
Yeah.
But let's get back to Abu Dhabi before.
Yeah. So then what happened? I got one day, I was looking at my emails. Man, it was 1998. I would see emails once a week. You know, emails was like the coolest thing. You know, I mean, it was something new. I remember internet was the one that did the, it was the Zing. Phone.
Yeah, yeah.
Like this.
Yeah, it's like it a fax like, machine. Yeah.
It took like 15 minutes for you to get online. I remember that, you know. And then I got an email saying, Abu Dhabi Submission Wrestling World Championship. I remember to this day. I was like, okay. So I opened an email and say, hey, Draculino, we would like to officially invite you for the World Submission Wrestling Competition to happen in Abu Dhabi, blah, 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 blah. And we're looking forward for your response, something like that. My English wasn't that great. And I read, I was like, man, is that tournament that Soccer told me about? Oh, shit, that's awesome. And they actually said on email, we really like your performance against the world champion Hoyler Gracie. We would like to have you on the under 65 kilo weight class. And I understood that. I was like, oh man, shit. But I didn't know what we are looking forward to. I didn't understand this expression. So I was like, what does that mean? Does it mean they still want me or
they're looking
for somebody else? I didn't know. I didn't know. So I remember asking one of my American students, I said, man, like, what does that mean? They really want me? Or they go like, oh, no, totally, man. They do want you. I was like, oh, shit. And then I replied to them, and that's what happened, you know. It was an amazing, amazing time. As a matter of fact, guess who was the person sitting next to me for the whole flight from Brazil to Frankfurt, and then from Frankfurt to Abu Dhabi. Guess who?
I don't know.
Carson.
Oh, perfect. Oh, good. Good.
Carson, man. I remember, man, it was like the funniest time. Like, he loved to play cards. And he liked to do tricks, card tricks. He loved to do card tricks. He was really good on that. Man, imagine 12-hour flight, then another 9-hour flight.
Oh.
I barely slept because he goes to me and say, hey, check that out. Check that out. And then we'll be playing cards for the whole trip. And man, it was like, it was amazing, man. I laughed like hard that whole trip. All the delegation, all the Brazilian delegation was in one flight. The flight was pretty much us. All of us.
Fantastic.
It was me, all the guys from my gym, me, Hanzo, Soca, and Ricardo Almeida, our four guys. And then we had like Amaury Bitecci, we had Playmobil, we had Murilo Bustamante, all the Carson guys, Liborio, and then we have Fabio Gugel, Roberto Travin. Everybody was on the same flight, you know what I mean? So he was, and Carson was the only coach. Carlinhos didn't go, and I remember Jack Red didn't go. Carson was the only coach. So he ended up kind of being like the coach of all of us. It was pretty cool, man.
Who was your roommate?
Soccer was my roommate.
Okay.
So Soccer's first... like one of my best friends, like top five my best friends.
So your first match is against Ryan Diaz?
Yes. The guy was like, his name is Ryan Diaz, but he was Japanese. It's the funniest thing in the world. If you look at the picture, I'm not saying Japanese. He was Asian for sure. He had some Asian background. And Soka actually fought another Japanese guy. That was exactly it. And this guy, Ryan Diaz, was pretty tough, very strong guy. I beat him quite easy on points. I couldn't submit. He was really hard to submit. Soka beat the guy too. And then me and Soka were in the second match.
See, that's the thing about Abu Dhabi. They don't care who you are, what team you are, and it started from the beginning. This isn't something that's recent. From the very beginning, you're going against your friend. You are
100% right. Yeah. I got pissed. Because let me tell you, not me, everybody on this situation got pissed. There's two things. Number one, this thing never happened in jiu-jitsu. In jiu-jitsu, teammates could only face each other in the finals.
In finals, yep.
That was cultural. That was the rules. That's how it was. And it was another thing, man. There was another thing. Back in the day, now it changed, you know, Mike. But back in the day, it was actually dishonorable for you to compete and to fight against a friend. A teammate, for you to compete against teammate, I'm telling you, back in that day, it was something that would be considered, everybody would be like, that's right or wrong, that was our culture. That's how it was.
Right, that's it. Yeah.
You know, and then we kind of like, when we saw the bracket the day off, we saw the bracket and I was like, oh man, I mean, we're going on the second fight. And he goes like, oh shit, maybe it's a mistake. I remember me and him going to Guy Nevens, who was the head organizer.
I know who Guy is, of course. Thing.
Yeah, yeah. And he said like, it's chance, it's luck. There's no such thing about teammates here, man. Sorry. And he said more. He said like, and look, if you guys don't fight, the guys that fought, I mean, if one of you guys decide not to fight, the guy who lost to you will fight the other guy. You know? So we're like, fuck, man. So, I mean, I did something that I hate to say, but I'm not gonna lie to you. I'm going to say the truth. We went there and he did a little training. Okay. And I told him, I say, Soccer, look, I just don't want to tap because I never tapped in competition. I don't want to tap now without even in a fake match. But, you know, so I said like, you know what? Sweep me at the end. Sweep me at the end. And then you win by 2-0. That's it. That's what happened.
Okay. So we have had, first off, I love ADCC history and we dig into it. We've had several people on here say, well, I had to go up against a teammate. And then I realized best throw and fastest submission get $5,000 each.
Yep.
I got both of them.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. I was too proud to have a tap on my record because you could have made that money. So like, fuck the money. I just don't want to tap.
You know what I mean? I mean, even Matt Serra said, yeah, I almost won a fight I was supposed to lose. I mean, it's just.
Exactly. I remember there was several. I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus here, Mike.
People talk about it.
Yeah, it was a lot of people, a lot of teammates that this happened. A lot.
Wow. You know, when you make teammates fight each other in the beginning, that's what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, but honestly, looking back, I'm not going to lie to you, man. I think they're right. If you want the sport to be in a certain level of professionalism, you know, like eventually, man, friends fight. You see that in the UFC, man, like a lot of great friends fight, like, for the title, making millions. And I mean, I don't see how they do it. Because I was raised in a different time.
Yeah.
But I understand. You know, it's like we say in Brazil, I understand, but I don't comprehend. You know what I mean? Like, I understand, man. You know, it's a professional. That's how it is. You know?
Did you ever roll with Sergio Iris?
Sergio Iris. No, never got the chance. Okay. Sergio Iris.
He's the guy that Carlson said was his best student ever.
Serginho. Oh, yeah, Sergio. Yeah. Serginho de Niterói. Sergio Iris was an iconic Carlson student. Arguably one of the top five Carlson students. He was a cop, actually. He was a cop. After he stopped jiu-jitsu, he turned into a cop. And if I'm not mistaken, I may be wrong. I think he got killed. He got murdered.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. That's him, right? That's true. That's
true. He was amazing. He used to give Hall's Gracie a hard time. That's what everybody said. He was that good. He was amazing. You know, but he was, man, Serginho was early 70s. I was a little kid, pretty much a baby. Okay. So it was before my time.
Okay. 1999, World's Court quarterfinals. Parampina is your opponent.
Alpia, yeah. Yeah, he amazing, amazing fighter from Carson too.
Yes.
Another Carson guy.
Did you hit him with several judo throws?
that's a funny one, this one, because here's the thing. Arrupinha is a black belt in judo. And for jiu-jitsu standards in our weight division, he was one of the best takedowns by far of all of us. Okay. He would take everybody down. I think there was just one guy that was better than him standing was Barbosa, Marco Barbosa. Barbosa was better than him in judo, but Pau Pia was just crazy good in judo. We competed the same year, 6 months before, and Pau Pia beat me by one advantage. I pulled guard right away because I didn't want to do judo with Pau Pia. I pulled guard. He couldn't pass my guard. I almost swept, but he actually, like when I grabbed his leg to try to get on top, he did a sumigaeshi on me and almost took me down. So he beat me by one advantage. It was a close match, but he beat me by one advantage. And when we competed again the same year at the Worlds, I was training a lot of judo, but nobody knew it. People knew that I had decent takedowns, but I was never known as a takedown guy. And guess what? I said, you know what, man, I'm going to surprise him because he's 100% sure I'm going to pull guard. And all of a sudden, we went at it, man, standing. it was a stand-up war. And I threw him with a beautiful morotesionaje, man. It's online.
Yeah.
Man, he came. I went like for a foot sweep underneath. And then like, wow. He went so hard that he didn't even stop. He bounced. Boom. It was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys were one-on-one, man.
Yeah, one-on-one. One-on-one. We just fought twice. But yes. Paupinha is great.
Savage.
And Paupinha nowadays, he's one of the main coaches of American Top Team.
Of course.
You see Paupinha, man, I told him the other day, we're good friends, you know. I told him, man, I don't know how you do it, man. Every single weekend I turn the TV on, you are cornering somebody. Every single weekend you're traveling all over the world still to be cornering people, man. Jeez, I don't know how you do it. He said, yeah, man, I'm getting a little old for that. I mean, I'm going to slow down a little bit. You're right, man. It's taking its toll. I don't know how he does it, man. He works whole week, has his own school. He goes to ATT to train fighters. He travels the whole weekend, comes back Sunday night, boom, again. The guy doesn't have a time off, man. He's a machine.
No. His wife is happy he's gone, or she's just...
Actually spoke about that, and I know her too. She's an amazing, amazing woman. She said, look, who am I to judge or to put any blockage on what brings us the life we have? That's his work. He's a good woman, man.
That's a very good woman. That's a good woman. Very good one. All right, so UFC 1, the referees, there's not a lot known about them. João Alberto Bejeta and Elio Vigio. What was their reputation in the jiu-jitsu world?
Legendary masters. João Alberto Barreto was arguably the best non-Gracie fighter on his time. He used to be the main training partner for Carson. That was the guy who gave Carson the hardest time in training. Amazing fighter, undefeated in Vale Tudo. There was a show in Brazil on the 60s, 50s or 60s. Like I have to check on that. Probably Robert Darzeio knows about that. There was a TV show in Brazil called Heróis do Ringue, which means the ring's heroes. Okay. Every Monday night, there was fights, Vale Tudo fights. You know, and João Alberto Barreto was the main events in almost every Monday. So the guy fought pretty much weekly for a long time, you know.
So what was Babalu? We had him on as well. Babalu.
An amazing guy. Good friend of mine, too. Babalu.
Yeah. Speaks very highly of you. He said, Babalu, I don't want to say anything bad, but Babalu is very rough. Growing up.
100%.
Okay, so Babalu, not afraid to go to jail. I mean,
not at all.
Not afraid. And, you know, maybe even would lean into the opportunity. Babalu said both of them were police officers. And at the time,
Hélio Vigil was. Hélio Vigil was the most feared cop in Rio by far.
Okay. See, he didn't say that. But he said, in jiu-jitsu, there's lots of arguing. Sometimes even actual fighting. Oftentimes the referees would be the starting point of violence because they didn't like the decision. With them, you could go to jail. And you would really go to jail. So it settled everything. You may have been unhappy, but you left unhappy rather than fighting at the tournament. Do you agree with that?
He's absolutely right. Like, I don't think, Mike, that João Alberto Barreto was a cop. Hélio Vigil was a cop. Hélio Vigil, in the 80s, he was the director of the division of the police in Rio that took care of the kidnappings. Because it was a crazy wave of kidnappings in Rio back in the day. People getting kidnapped left and right. It was crazy. People getting killed. They getting the money, killing the person. It was horrible. And then when Hélio Vigil took over, in 6 months, there was no kidnapping in Rio anymore. You know why?
He took care of business.
He took care of business.
Yeah.
No kidnapper was alive after they got caught. None. They all died. So he told in the press, if you're a kidnapper, sooner or later, you will go to hell. I'm taking you straight to hell. So think twice. Amazing guy. I was really good friends of his son, Hadley Vigil. Hadley was also an amazing jiu-jitsu fighter. And his son, Hadley, got shot one time in Rio, man. Like, they tried to rob his car. He tried to react. He was a cop, too. They shot him. They shot him on the neck. And there was a bullet that got, like, stuck on the... Yeah. And he got paraplegic. Yeah. He passed away a couple years ago. God bless his soul. And it was terrible, man. It was terrible. That happened in the early 90s or something. It was really bad. Really great guy, Hadley Vigil.
2002. You were on a Desafio card. Desafio?
2002. It was in 2002. Uh-huh.
I could not find an opponent, but I also know at that point, Bob Lee
was the no-gi. The no-gi. It was a gi or no-gi, this one? Remind me, please.
There's no video. I found a post in Portuguese that I translated.
Okay, okay.
What's your name on it?
Yeah, it was a super fight event. Nowadays, what you see is who's number one, Metamores, all these things were happening in Brazil forever. You know, I participated in a bunch of them. And I was a main event on this one. I competed against a guy called Gabriel Cardoso. And Gabriel was from the Brazilian judo team in judo. And he was a world champion in the brown belt in jiu-jitsu. Okay. Very tough kid. Very, very tough kid. You know, one of those kids that are hard to do anything. It's not like he doesn't go for a whole lot of submissions. He wasn't too dangerous for submission, but he couldn't do shit to him. He was really, really hard to sweep, hard to take down, very athletic, like a gas tank that could go like for days. He was just a kind of like a super athlete. Pressure. And I beat him by points, but it was a pretty cool thing because I got a back take on him that kind of like a lot of people didn't know back in the day. That nowadays everybody knows, which is the arm drag, back take.
Of course.
But when I did, I remember a lot of people asking, man, Drag, how did you do that? Man, you do like, you kind of like cross his arm and all of a sudden you are in his back. And I said like, okay, man, watch me fight and then you're going to learn a little bit more. I'm not teaching you.
Take some notes. Bring a pen. Yeah,
I remember. I think it was this event. Yeah, this event that you're talking about. I competed against this guy. He's still very active in judo. And I think he was one of the main coaches of the Brazilian team, if I'm not mistaken. I saw the other day on Twitter. Very, very nice guy, too. Very good guy.
The Desafio events would also do NHB fighting. They would do tournaments with stomps and headbutts.
Yes. This
was not it.
I want to say MMA. Let me say Vale Tudo, right? Because it was a different sport.
NHB
Vale
Tudo. Tudo.
Yeah, NHB, no host board. Man, like... It was a different time, like, because a lot of times we did these fights, like, in dojo challenges. It was a very common thing for us to do. I actually did a couple that were like pretty much a fight with no rules in the dojo. So whenever I did my first professional fight that I got paid, a lot of people, oh, this is Draculino's debut. And I did really good. And people say, fuck that, Draculino. No, you hiding your record. You have a lot of fights before. I said, like, yeah, I had a lot of fights before, but none were sanctioned. I just had the experience of having to do this several times.
Did you participate in the Gracie Challenge?
No.
You weren't one of the people.
No. Look. Gracie Challenge, that's what I did. We did. But I wasn't on the official ones that they did in the garage and all that. No.
Okay.
No, because I wasn't related in the jiu-jitsu. In the jiu-jitsu world, I wasn't directly related to these guys, to Horion, to Hoist, to Hickson. I
actually fought a blood relation. Okay.
I fought Hoyler, like competed against Hoyler. So the Gracie Challenge was more on this side of the family. It was like Horion's and Elio's side of the family. But pretty much what we did, what you see in the Gracie Challenges, that's what we did. It was exactly the same thing.
We'll call those amateur fights because you never got paid.
I never got paid. But and there was no money to it, you know. And even though, like, when there was money, man, it was like no money pretty much.
Right.
You know, we didn't fight for money.
No, we fought for honor.
We fought for honor. Yeah. We fought for defending our flags, for love. There was no money. There was no internet. Like, you know, if you were on TV or in a little bitty piece of paper on the newspaper, you're lucky. It was never our thing. You know what I mean?
So, pride. Yeah, it was pride. Which 100%. Is worth much more than any cash value.
100%. 100%. 100%.
Were you at Abu Dhabi in 2003? May 17th, it was when he was in Rio.
Yes, I was there. I didn't compete, but I was there. I was there.
But I saw you in the audience. Okay, so... Yeah. People don't talk about this event enough. So in essence, ADCC goes to Rio. It's the Gracie homecoming. They're going to be there in front of their country to represent their sport.
Mike, actually, just one small correction. It was in Sao Paulo, this one.
It was in Sao Paulo. I apologize.
Sao Paulo.
Sao Paulo. Yes. It's in Brazil. Man, dude, my Draculino. Man, thank you. So it's their homecoming coming back to their country. And yes. In essence, if you look at what took place, you had Eddie Bravo beating Hoyler.
That was crazy.
You had Pablo Popovich over Marcelo Fiatosa. You had Jacare over Hayan Gracie. Mm-hmm. And Hadger Gracie, who was favored to win, loses in the fourth round against John Olaf.
Yeah, John Olaf, the Swedish guy. Yeah, the big guy. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was exactly it.
It was a
and Hansel lost to Marcelo Garcia too.
Right? That's correct. So it's a clean Gracie sweep, and the following ADCC Hodger does incredible,
destroyed everybody, submitted everybody. Yeah,
but at this point, you guys had to be looking around like, brother, like what's the conversations like?
Man, that was a good one. I remember when you talk about Hoyler and Eddie Bravo, at the same time Hoyler and Eddie Bravo were going, I was coaching soccer on the mat next to it. It was Eddie Bravo versus Hoyler, and soccer was going against Barrett Yoshida on the other mat.
Of course, Barrett, legend, another legend.
Amazing guy too. Yeah, amazing, amazing grappler. And I remember there was coaching soccer and I, you know, the other mat was like to the left and was kind of like coaching soccer, but looking a little bit to see. And I just remember seeing Hoyler like swept him really easy, passed his guard like nothing, put the knee on belly. It was kind of like all over him. So it was kind of like, okay, that's expected, you know, like no big deal. Yeah. Nobody knew.
Hoyler.
Nobody knew who Eddie Bravo.
Eddie was, no.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, I remember everybody, I just listened. I just heard, ooh, the audience. Oh, why is this? When I look, Hoyler's inside the triangle. I was like, oh, shit, man. Dang. I didn't even see how he ended up in there because I just looked because I heard the commotion. And then all of a sudden, Hoyler taps. I was like, man. That's huge. Oh, my God. Because Hoyler was the man. He was three times consecutive times ADCC champion, four times world champion. You know, he beat me three times. He was the man. Nobody could touch him. Mm. And then an American guy that nobody knows who he was comes and do that. And then I remember also with the other one you said, also Marcelo Garcia and Hanzo too. Marcelo Garcia was a brown belt that never trained no gi and did what he did. And people said, like, is that a nightmare, man? What the fuck is going on? Is that a real, is that a dream, or is that really happening? You know, but yeah, I was there. It was like a big shock. And I think a lot of the performance of Jorge that year was the dedication that we, it shook us a little bit. The Gracie guys, I'd say. It shook us and said, like, man, you know what? We have to push it back more. You have to, you know, amp our thing. Otherwise, you know, man, we're going to be eating alive. So, you know, we trained double and, you know, took, again, the biggest title. But, you know, jiu-jitsu was never the same again, let me tell you.
No. And, you know, in 2005, Jorge Gracie, arguably the greatest performance in ADCC history.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
I agree with you.
We've had the table judges and the actual referee of on in regards to what took place with Hoyler. All of them said, like, the air left the building, like, and including themselves, like, even they were in shock. And you know what that means? That's how much respect Hoyler had. You can't get that reaction unless you've earned the type of air that's in the
building. It was crazy. Yes. It was a dead silence. That's what happened. I remember when there was in the triangle, everybody kind of, ooh, you know, that kind of sound that people, what is this? And then after the tap, there was like a few Americans. I remember Joe Rogan was there with Eddie and like crying, like, like clapping hands. But everybody else just quiet. And I remember that Grandmaster Elio was on the VIP area, kind of like on top of the stadium there watching. And I remember everybody kind of looked towards his direction and he was just looking. 5 minutes later, he left.
Gerald Strebent was there as well. It was Rogan and Strebent. Truly, truly an incredible moment, but also that's how you get greatness. You have to get pushed.
Man, 100%. It was needed, man. Everything that happened was needed. It was the internationalization, if that word exists, I don't know, of jiu-jitsu, man. I mean, it could not just be in the Brazilian hands anymore. You know, it had to be, it's a world thing nowadays. You know, now we have good people everywhere.
Okay, you know? So at this point, you're well-established within Gracie Baja. In 96, you opened up the first Gracie Baja, you know, school.
Outside of Rio, yeah.
Outside of Rio, yes, that's correct. In 2003, you decide to fight in Heat FC against Kleber Gaudino.
Kleber Gaudino,
why?
This is why. Like, I had a lot of fights before that I didn't get paid nothing. And the MMA thing was started to blow up a lot because of Pride, Mike. Pride in Japan was the event that everybody wanted to be part of. And this event, Heat FC, was considered the Brazilian Pride because it was a super production, huge event. And I remember that I got invited to fight on this event because, I mean, I was well-known in jiu-jitsu. And also, I had already students that were fighting in the big leagues. So I said, you know what, man? I'm not one of those guys that will be a great MMA coach. And I never did a professional fight. This is unacceptable for me. I'm not judging whoever never did it. Not at all. We have amazing coaches that never had
it's
any
crazy.
Professional fights.
It's
amazing
crazy.
Coaches.
Yes. Yes.
I am not saying that I think it's wrong or anything. I think it's just a preference. But me being a competitor all my life and having made these fights, I said, like, man, I feel here like a swimming coach that never jumped on the pool. I have to jump on this pool, man. You know, I was on this pool, but in a different scenario.
It's different,
I didn't get paid. There was no money. There was no mic. There was no camera, nothing. Now it is. So I need to experience that. Because otherwise, I'm not going to pass to my students. This is my head, okay? I'm not saying it's true. I'm not going to pass the confidence to them when I coach them. Now, after I did my fights, I did three professional fights, I can tell them, like, look, this is normal. This is going to happen. You get a little nervous. The first year takes a little bit longer to go. And then the second year comes. It's normal to feel a little tired in the beginning. All that stuff, that only if you're there, you know. Now I can tell them. I knocked people out. I submitted people, and I got knocked out. So even though in three fights, I have like a big
spectrum
of shit that happened.
You got everything.
You know what I mean? Exactly. So exactly. I was lucky enough. And that's why I thought in my mind that I needed to be there. I needed to put my skin on the fire. You know what I mean? To be, how can I say the word? I don't want to use the wrong word. To be.
You don't want to be contradictory. You want to be what it is you say.
I say that because I was there. It's not because I read on the books or people told me. I was there.
Right.
So trust me. You know what I mean?
So yeah, you win by arm triangle, event, right? Yeah.
Arm triangle. This guy that I fought, there was no internet. I didn't have any footage about the guy. I had no idea about who this guy was, except that he was a black belt in jiu-jitsu from Nova Union. And Nova Union is an amazing team.
Legit.
And he had five professional fights. That's all I knew. I didn't know the face. I didn't know anything about the guy. And then when I got there, I asked some of jiu-jitsu guys in the area, I say, man, it was me and Roberto Gordo, my corner man. What's up with this guy? What's his game? What does he do? And all the guys from the area said, like, good jiu-jitsu black belt, very heavy hand. That's the only thing they said. I say, okay, really? Then I asked somebody else, hey, what's up with this guy? Jiu-jitsu black belt, very heavy hand. Be careful. So I was like, shit, man, he must have a heavy hand, you know? But I was really well prepared, Mike. I was in really good shape. My preparation was great. My stand-up was not even close to what he got after, but it was decent enough to have distance management, to protect, to get some angles and all that. So I did really good, and I beat the guy, and the local people got shocked because they were making the party to put the Carioca guy, the Rio de Janeiro guy, to be like slaughtered by the local guy. So there was 7,000 people in that stadium saying it was huge. Babalu fought the same night. Shimu fought the same night. Alan Goyce fought the same night. Forrest Griffin fought the same night. It was a big, big card. It was pretty cool.
Nino Schembri, you've worked out with him before.
Oh, man. Actually, as a matter of fact, 6 months ago, I was teaching here in my school in Texas. And all of a sudden, I look at the entrance. Man, freaking Nino comes in. I was like, I didn't talk to Nino for years. We kind of like, we're friends, but we kind of lost contact a little bit. I look at him, it's like, what the heck are you doing here, man? And then I gave him a hug. And he said, like, no, yeah, I'm going to teach a seminar close by tomorrow. I just came by to see you, and we can maybe have lunch and all that. And I spent the afternoon with him. We talked a lot. It was a great time. He trained. He was amazing, man. That guy was one of the most brilliant jiu-jitsu fighters of all times. He was something else. Unbelievable.
Where were you when he fought Sakuraba?
I was in Brazil. I remember when he knocked him out with the knee. It was crazy.
They tried to serve him like a fish. Here's your sacrificial lamb. Highlight video.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
there
was
stomps and kicks and
They put him there to be like we say in Brazil, to be the cattle that they feed the piranhas. You know what I mean? Like to throw the cattle to the piranhas, and that was it. But guess what? It didn't do it right. It didn't go well to the Japanese that day.
Yes, I think I have him next week. I've been in communication with him. He's one of my favorite.
He's amazing, man. He's amazing. He's a good soul too. Amazing guy.
One of the things that interests me also is the mindset of fighters. On December 3rd, 2005, you were in England for Cage Rage, and you cornered Vitor Belfort.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've heard stories. How is Vitor pre-fight in the locker room?
Honestly, man, in total disclosure, I heard from credible sources about horror stories about Vitor in the locker room before fights. But the two fights that are cornering him, He was extremely professional. He was ready, mentally ready. Absolutely nothing to talk about him in this regard. Absolutely nothing. He went there. He kicks the guy's ass. Two really tough guys. When I cornered him two times in Cage Rage, he was relaxed. He was like joking. He was ready, on point. I have in this case, you know, I have nothing to say. I didn't see myself nothing, but I did hear a lot of stories. I wasn't there, so I prefer not to disclose.
So you were warned before you went over there. Expect this.
Yes.
And for a person like Vitor Belfort to have pre-fight nerves, it means it's okay for everybody. Because Belfort's a friggin' savage, man.
That's what we said before, man. I mean, like, everybody gets like that. But the problem is that what do you do with your fear? That's the biggest problem. The fear will come to everyone. Man, if you get in a fight, we say in Brazil this expression. If somebody tells you right now, for example, hey, Mike, now go downstairs. You have to fight the popcorn guy that sells popcorn on the corner. You have to fight him right now. Even though you know that most likely you're going to beat the heck out of him, you will get nervous.
Nervous you should be.
You will. That's how it is, man. I mean, like, whoever says, like, oh, I'm ice cold. I don't feel nothing when I fight. This is bullshit. If you are like that, you either retarded or, you know, you're
lying.
Something.
Or you're lying. Yeah, you're lying.
Or you're lying. Yeah. Or you're on something. Like, I don't, well, God knows where what. Everybody gets a little bit of nerves, man. This is very common to us. But what you do with these nerves, that's the makes the difference, you know.
In 2007, you formed the Gracie Fusion MMA team. It's a team that combined you with Gordo, Hyam Gracie, and yourself. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
How did this come about? Why did you guys decide to kind of get together?
This was the thing, Mike. We are all from Gracie Barra, of course. This is our jiu-jitsu family, right? And Gracie Barra was already like super well-established on the jiu-jitsu world. On the MMA world, Carson was the number one team.
Yeah.
With more fighters. And then after Carson was BTT. And then Shootbox came into place too. And Carlinhos, my master, always loved MMA, but he never wanted to get involved too much. He did, because he was so focused on the other sports aspect of it that he didn't want to get involved. So we felt that we needed to get people that wanted to get involved and kind of like be like a leadership for the dozens of fighters that we had that wanted to fight MMA and kind of take them under our wings and get this done. So I remember I went to Carlinhos to talk to him. And I said, look, Carlinhos, I was the first one to talk to him, actually. I was actually closer to him. And I was like, hey, Carlinhos, look, this is what's going on. What do you think?
Yeah, make changes.
Yeah. And Carlinhos said, man, like, go ahead, do that. I mean, you know that I cannot be involved directly in that, but go ahead, do your thing. You know, he pretty much gave us like the go ahead, you know. And we started to do it because we wanted to be a very strong presence in Japan. Our goal was to be strong in Pride. And, man, we had a really, really good roster of fighters in my school. A lot of great guys with Gordo and a lot of great guys with Hyam. So we put everybody under the same umbrella and competing under the same flag. And we put some people to fight in Japan, man. I mean, like, in Pride, there was more the Gracies. It was Hyam and Ralph and Hanzo. Daniel Gracie fought in Pride too. But in smaller events in Japan, we fought too. We have like several guys fighting. And also I remember Babalu was still like, when Babalu first fought in UFC, I think when he first fought, he was from Ruas Vale Tudo.
Yes.
And then when he joined us, he actually fought in UFC again. I remember he fought this wrestler, Travis Wyeth, and he submitted him in a triangle. Babalu did. And he was also in our flag, under our flag, Gracie Fusion. So we started to make waves, man. We started to make waves. It was working well. you know.
For the English speaking people, Travis View was the guy that he submitted with the triangle.
Travis View, yes, he submitted. It was a beautiful fight. Beautiful fight.
Yeah, 100 fight. This guy has 100 fights. You guys also had Joaquim Mahmoud Ferreira.
My student, dude. My direct student. Yeah.
Beat Junior Dos Santos, man.
Broke his arm.
Jesus.
Yeah, was the only guy that actually submitted him that fast. And he was actually one of the Gracie Fusion guys too. My direct student, black belt of mine, amazing guy. He's living in Qatar right now. Actually, he works for the military in Qatar. And man, yeah, it was going great. It was very promising, Mike, until Ryan passed away.
Okay. So Ryan has quite a reputation, and there's no hiding it. Like,
of course not.
You watch one of his fights, you know, man, that guy. There's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
What was he like dealing with on a business side?
Man, believe it or not, in this venture, it was the easiest thing in the world. Ryan was 100% altruistic. He wasn't the one that tried to impose his ideas only. He listened to us. He actually gave us zero problem with all that. It was actually like great because he was an idol in Japan. People loved him in Japan. He was the bad boy. You know, because you watch his fights in Pride. He even almost fought the ref a bunch of times. You know, so he was like, man, he was the main figure of the team. I'm not gonna lie, because number one, he was a Gracie, and number two, he was super uber famous in Japan.
Yeah,
and he never treated me or Gordo as kind of like up below him. Not at all, zero. I'm telling you with all my heart. So in this, it was extremely easy to deal with him on the business side.
I'd say that's exactly the opposite answer that I had expected. And I know you're being truthful. Like,
I'm telling you, but look, don't get me wrong. Ryan was far to be an easy guy to deal with. We know each other since I was just were kids. We were like close friends for decades. And oh boy, if you start to tell the stories here, that will be like a podcast of 2 months of the craziness. Yes. Of the craziness that we've been through. And trust me, Ryan was far to be an easy guy on the personal side. But let me tell you, man, he's like a brother to me. I love him. Still do. It was a big shock when he passed away. We got devastated, even though like he was struggling with a lot of demons. We did not expect. When that happened, we did not expect at all. It was a tough, tough thing that happened, you know. And man, it was like. And then honestly, man, Gracie Fusion pretty much died a couple of months after. Me and Gordo were really sad. I ended up moving to America in January 2008, so I couldn't give the same attention and time for this thing. Actually, Gordo was also very kind of like. Gordo was a little bit, he kind of like lost interest a little bit in MMA too, because MMA is a different world, you know, than jiu-jitsu. It's like,
it's not the same.
Not the same, you know, and then the thing died out, you know. I mean, like sometimes I think about it. I remember that I had a meeting with Kira Gracie, for us to maybe try to do something with the brand again. This was like a long time ago, but I think without Ryan, it didn't make any sense, you know, honestly.
Okay. Marcio Fiatoso, 2001 ADCC champion. Mm-hmm. Experiences with him.
Yeah, man, Marcio is a longtime teammate of mine. We're still in the same organization, Gracie Barra, me and him. He's the right hand of Master College Gracie Jr., always was for a long, long time. And man, like one of the best competitors in jiu-jitsu that I've ever seen. Marshall is one of those guys that if I want to compare his style in jiu-jitsu for somebody in MMA, he was like GSP. He was like a guy who would not have a hole in his game. And he didn't necessarily submit all the people. He wasn't like the flashiest guy, but he would shut everybody's game down 100%. Just as GSP did. VSP used to get wrestlers and take them down and shut them down. GSP used to get like amazing strikers and take them down and beat them up. He would like, GSP was the master on shutting people's games down completely. Yeah. People couldn't do shit to him. And Marshall was exactly the same thing. So amazing competitor. Like he was a machine on not making mistakes. I don't recall Marshall making any mistakes. He was like, I think two or three times world champion, ADCC champion, and a Brazilian champion a zillion times. He was Pan Am champion. He was an amazing competitor. Very strategic, very good.
Speaking of machines, Brandon Mullins.
Uh-huh. My student, my dear student. He is a nice encyclopedia. Now there's no encyclopedia anymore. Now it's Google, right?
Yeah.
I say he's kind of like Google in jiu-jitsu, man. That guy knows everything and a little more about jiu-jitsu. He is extremely well-rounded. He is extremely knowledgeable. Black belt in judo. Wrestler of high caliber. Amazing everywhere jiu-jitsu. Good guard, good passing, good defense, good stamina, good, like, and overall technique. Amazing guy. He was two-time world champion, no-gi world champion. Under me, he's been a student of mine forever. My right-hand man here in Texas for ages. And nowadays, he's working as an engineer. So he used to teach tons of classes. Now he just teaches three classes a week for me. He still does. But he's is an engineer. And he works for a big, huge company, engineer company. I forgot the name now. But I was just with him just right now. He showed up the school to print some documents. And I said, like, man, like, print in your home. Don't get my paper. This costs money. I was making his balls a little bit.
Amal Easton.
Amazing guy. Amazing guy. One of the first originals Americans that moved to Brazil and pretty much lived years in Brazil. A lot of people don't know that. He actually moved to Baja and lived there in a very simplistic way for years, man, learning from the source. And now he has a
Nine schools.
And nine big schools in Colorado. And doing really well. He deserves every bit of this. A really good guy. I really like him. Amal is an amazing soul too.
Alberto Crane.
My student, my direct student. And actually, it's funny that I said Alberto Crane because Alberto came to live in Brazil because of Amal.
Of Amal. That's correct.
You know, right? So they're really good friends. And Alberto first moved to Rio to be with Amal. And he trained in Rio a little bit. But then he went to Belo, to the city that I had my school, the first school outside of Rio. He went to Belo. And he trained in Belo for a week. He just went to train him for a week and to come back. But he loved there so much. He loved my style of teaching that he moved to Belo instead and lived there for 4 years. He didn't go back to America for 4 years. Then he went back, stayed there for 6 months because he was broke in Brazil, made some cash, came back and stayed two more years. He speaks fluent Portuguese. Amal also speaks fluent Portuguese.
He speaks fluent German, fluent
German
English,
too.
Spanish.
German. Yes.
And I think his wife is Armenian.
She's Armenian.
Armenian. He speaks that too.
Yes. So he is amazing.
He obviously departed Gracie Baja.
Yes,
and
yes.
In our interview with him, it's something that got brought up. And he said, in essence, I knew who my friends were after that took place.
Yeah.
And he said, the only thing that mattered to me was the opinion of Draculino. And he said, hey, brother, we're friends. That's just business.
Yeah.
He said, it meant the world to me.
But he's 100% right. I remember that the business models that he had were not a good fit for Gracie Barra. And he tried out of loyalty. He tried really hard, but it was just impossible. The way he wanted to do things did not fit on the business model of Gracie Barra. And I said, look, that's exactly what I said. You're right. I said, like, look, in between me and you personal, nothing changes. I still love you. You're my student. Never going to change. You're going to come to my house. I'm going to help your family, going to help my family. Nothing changes. Just on the business side, I get it. You just cannot do this way. So be it, man. I mean, what is the problem? He left, like we say in Brazil, man, he left with the door open. Some people leave with the door closed.
No.
He left with the door open. You know, he did the right thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And he, it's not an easy thing for somebody who he's the first satellite school, Gracie Baja, in the United States. And, you know, sometimes there's growing pains. It's okay.
It's okay. Happens. Exactly. Yeah, it's and okay. He's doing great by himself, too. His school is huge in Glendale. Burbank. Burbank. Sorry, Burbank.
He's got like three of them. Yes.
Yeah. He has one in Pasadena, too, I think. Yeah.
Cristiano Titi Lazzanini.
Yeah, Chichi.
That's your boy.
Yeah, my boy. My one of my first students in Belo too, man. Amazing guy, like a brother to me. One of the best students I ever made. Like a super technical and also a freak of nature. You see the guy's picture, he's like looks like an incredible Hulk, man. You know, so he's like until today on the Masters Division, one of the best that there is. He's like also like a school owner, very successful school owner, has a beautiful family. I love that guy. He's an amazing guy too. You bring in some really good names. No asshole so far.
Okay. Now, you know what? I've got a couple of assholes, but I'm not going to name them. I'm going to keep this interview nice.
Let's keep it positive, right?
100%. That is my goal. Marcelo Azevedo.
Azevedo, his nickname is Urapuru. He's actually one of my partners in one school here in Brazil as well. We have a school together that is pretty much like maybe 15 miles, like 15, 17 miles from my house. And he's doing really well too on the school. Amazing fighter. Like he competes often. The guy loves competing. He still competes on the Master Division. He was like world champion of Master Division, Pan Ams. Amazing, amazing fighter. And I mean, he's been my student for almost 30 years now. Him and Chichi, for example, you know, the guys that are with me for a lifetime. Great guy, too.
Did you train with Braulio Estima when he was in lower belts?
Yes. Him and a lot of his brother. Always an amazing guy. I always knew those guys were different. Him and Victor, his brother. Otavio Souza, too. Those guys that came from the Northeast, they were beasts. You know, and really cool to see when the lower belts that, man, they struggle, man. They used to come from the Northeast sometime by bus. It took like 2-3 days to come to Rio. And, man, like sleeping like the shittiest conditions and eat very frugal just to be able to train and compete. And the success that they have right now is very well deserved, too. You know, I knew those kids would go far. And sure enough, look at them now.
6-time world champion Samuel Braga.
My boy too, my student. My student since blue belt, you know. He was arguably the best little guy that I ever formed. Like, direct student of mine, technique-wise, I don't see nobody touching him. On his prime, he was a monster, man. I'm telling you right now. Okay, a monster. So, unstoppable.
What I think people at home need to understand is that there isn't anybody in a Gracie Baja system that has more black belts than you. Nobody. Correct?
Yes. Correct.
Okay. But you also are not a black belt factory. You have the traditional timelines of everybody else.
Exactly.
Okay. What is the secret to keep people coming back and not leaving? Because nobody has figured this out like you have.
You are, and I appreciate your words, man. Like,
that's true.
Yeah. I'm blessed because that's not the norm, as you know. That's not normal. Not at all. Right. So I believe that everything that I did as a leader was more to inspire than to talk. I would talk, but I would do it. Everything that I did, I think. I did it not because I wanted to show off. I did from my heart, and through my actions, I inspire my guys to go to the honorable route. Man, I can be a difficult guy. I can be sometimes cranky. I am a little aggressive sometimes. I'm far to be a saint, you know.
we all have issues, right?
Of course. But man, like one thing, I'm real. What you see is what you get. And I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to like bullshit you, excuse my French. I am true to my honor code, and I live by it. I live and die by it. That's the way I am. That's it. I don't force things. And I think people relate to that. Because in a world today that everybody is only politically correct, the world today, everything is fast recognition. Everything is like, you cannot offend anybody. Oh, they have to actually be careful to your words. Man, I was never like that. I am not an animal. I am polite, and I'm not completely like without any filter. I'm not like that. But I won't bullshit and sugarcoat things to you, man. I won't. If the truth is the truth, you will hear the truth. If the rule is this, I cannot open an exception to you and not open an exception to Mike. What I do to Mike, I have to do with Romulo Bahal.
And to you, and to yourself.
And to myself, exactly. You know what I mean? And I think people relate to that. So yeah. My guys, like they always, that's whenever you ask them, pretty much I think the characteristic that they say that they enjoy more in me is this, being real. You know, like I'm true to myself. And as a leader, I think it goes a long way, brother. You know, because you can say whatever you want, man. But if your actions go in another route, it's not going to stick. You know, it's not going to stick. You know, and it will be short life. You know, and thank God, man. I mean, like, honestly, people don't like the way I am and the way that I lead. I care less. You have a lot of other options. But that's the way I am. I'm not going to sugarcoat, and I'm not going to lick everybody's ass to please everybody. I'm not like that. It's just the way it is, you know.
The system is working. So the people.
It is working.
It's a very small percentage. So
yeah, you know, it's working. Yeah. I'm not going to change. Too late.
right. All right. Sometimes when you have a chef, oftentimes you need to have other people talk about ingredients in order to make something special.
100%.
Both you and Henzo came up with the spider guard. How does the conversation take place? What is the study sessions look like?
That's an interesting story because for the record, Mike, for the record, for you, recording, okay? I did not invent the spider guard. I actually copied Henzo by seeing Henzo doing at the training sessions. Henzo was a smaller guy, as you know. Henzo was like featherweight. I was like rooster weight. It was even smaller than him. And I saw that he could defend himself doing the spider guard with really big guys, and the guys couldn't pass his guard. So the defensive part of the spider guard, I copied from Henzo because I was always small. I was always on the bottom. I didn't want people passing my guard left and right. And I found out that doing the spider guard, people couldn't pass my guard easy. As contrary, you know, they got him pissed. He couldn't pass because I was always flexible. What I think that my contribution to the spider guard was is that I got so obsessed by it that I started to put attacks into it, Mike. I wasn't only defending. I was defending, but through my defense, I was doing a lot of attacks. So that basic combo of the spider guard simple sweep to triangle, nobody taught me. I started to do it because I saw it there in training competition. And man, like, let me tell you, I got a lot of people on that one. Nowadays, it's like, still people still tap on that. Like the other day, like Keenan Cornelius tapped to Felipe Andrew on this basic move. You know what I mean? But it's very effective. But man, I used to get everybody on this thing. Everybody. I would either sweep them to mount, or I would get them on a triangle. And when they pause on the triangle, I pat tap them on the armbar. So I was vicious on this thing. And then I think that this combo turning to be like the foundation of the modern spider guard game.
100%.
You know, there's a lot of variations that come into this. So I think that if you want to put my contribution is that, first of all, I was, as far as I remember, I was one of the first to do it in competition, like often. I actually got shit from a lot of people. Man, Draculino, I want to host this league and stay there. What an ugly game. Fuck that. Blah, blah, blah. You know how it is. Like people always hate.
Hate
normal.
Yeah.
But I got a little bit of hate on that too. But he was just effective. He was working. And then that's what a lot of people say. Oh, man, I think Draculino was the one that invented Spider-Guard. No. I did not invent the Spider-Guard.
You built the foundation, built on top of the foundation.
I did a little bit. Threw the solid analysis that I did with Hanzo. And then everybody, nowadays is one of the most common guards. So,
but it's a phenomenal foundation, and you can build different houses on it.
100%. You have a lot of options from there.
Yes,
it's a very intelligent game, actually.
Hanzo. In a family of legends, Hanzo's my favorite Gracie.
Hanzo's like a favorite person of a bunch of people, man. Hanzo's very charismatic. He's a very truthful guy. Also, like, what you see is what you got. Same thing with him. And he's a badass, too. I mean, Hanzo has the perfect storm.
Big time. Yeah. Let's talk about Roleta.
Legendary. Esquijitsu, we call him Esquijitsu, which means weird jitsu. That's a translation. Because Roleta's things, only Roleta could do. If Roleta was teaching a seminar of his stuff, that would be extremely hard for people to follow, because back in the day, only Roleta could do Roleta things. Roleta did the most bizarre and most unseen things from the guard position that, man, what he did to Walid Ismail on that legendary match. He went upside down, and then seems like Walid was completely smashing his head connected to his knee. All of a sudden, he goes, whoa, Walid was flying. And then people, whoa, what was that? And all that. And Roleta had a bunch of these things. Roleta's an engineer, too. Very intelligent guy. And he actually put a lot of the principles of engineer into his guard, believe it or not. Very intelligent guy. And a lot of people also remember Roleta for the guard, but Roleta was a great guard passer too, man. Amazing competitor. One of the best of the 90s by far.
Yeah, the inverted. Yeah, the inverted guard. Rafael Sapo Natal.
My student too, my brother. Sapo was one of the best souls that I know. What a truthful, honorable, tough as nails, amazing guy, hard worker. Man, Sapo is an amazing human being. And I know some people get jealous with what I'm going to say now, but in between all the fighters, there are several that I trained, that I coached, that I cornered. Nobody has the heart of a lion as Sapo. Sapo is the real Braveheart. You have to kill him to stop him. He's not going to stop. And is a lot of people say this, oh, you got to kill me to beat me. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Trust me, this Mike. That guy is like that. I saw him in all adversity that you can imagine. And he never quits. Never quits. It's kind of like a zombie that comes after you. You literally have to rip his head off to stop
it. UFC veteran. And ladies and gentlemen, just people on YouTube, here is my list of all of his students. It's innumerable. And
more than 1,000 black belts.
It's for me to go through it, it's not possible. I just kind of pull some highlights here. Barral. Romulo Barral, six-time ADCC 2013 world
champion. ADCC, five-time world champion, Hall of Famer in jiu-jitsu. Yeah.
Well, here let's talk about 2013 ADCC. Kim Dong, it's his first opponent in Korea. Mm-hmm. He's from Korea.
Yes.
Lucas Lete, his second opponent.
Very tough guy. Lucas Lete is a very, very tough guy, too. Amazing half guard.
Keenan Cornelius is after
another one. Yeah.
And then he wins his title against Rafael Lovato.
Look at the lineup that he beat. Yeah. Crazy. Romulo is, I said about Sapo, about the heart, about toughness and the mental toughness. And I would say Romulo for dedication. I never saw any of my students work as hard as him. He's the hardest working student that I ever had. Some guys come really close. I have a student of mine now, Lucas Valente, new generation, like unbelievable work ethic as well. But Romulo is something out of this world, man. It's unbelievable. Like even high level people like Braulio, for example, Braulio, when Braulio was living with him in England, Braulio said, like, man, there's no way to hang out with Romulo in training, man. It's out of this world. This guy's a machine. I cannot believe he can do what he does. You know what I mean? It's like discipline, focus, intensity, 24/7, doesn't matter. No excuse.
Discipline.
You just do it.
Discipline.
You know?
Let's talk about your third black belt, Takeo Tani.
Takeo Tani. Takeo is in Singapore. Takeo also is an amazing guy. Crazy. Like you guys say here in America, batshit crazy guy. But very good heart, very good soul. Very tough guy too. Little guy, man. He's a little guy. Like, I'm big compared to him, just so you know. And I'm a small guy. World champion of no-gi. Amazing, amazing fighter. He's in Singapore right now. He bounced around a bunch of places, man. I call him the gypsy. I tell him, man, you got to settle down, man. No. Oh, professor, I'm in Singapore for over 10 years. Okay, fine. So stay there. Don't move anymore. Because he was like in Brazil all over. Yeah, in Brazil all over. Then to Japan. He went to a bunch of different cities in Japan. Then from Japan, he went to, I think, to the Philippines. And then from the Philippines, he went to Thailand. And then like Singapore's like, man, settle down, bro. But great guy.
2003 world champion Eric Wanderley.
Oh, one also off. I mean, if I want to say rough talent, natural talent, like physical specimen, you teach one thing for him, he does in competition high level the same day. It's a guy who he was born to fight. He was born with a gift. God put this guy on earth to fight. He couldn't do anything else other than fight. He's like the perfect machine to fight. Everything that you need in a fighter, the guy just has it. He has heart, great technique. He learns fast. He's one of the strongest physically athletes I ever had. Ask anybody who trained with him. And he got successful. You know, like he was just a freaking monster. Eric, man, in his prime, let me tell you this. If he was a little more dedicated, he would be absolute world champion for sure. For sure. The reason why he was not, he was weight class and got close. It was because he could have trained a little more. He could have dedicated just a little tiny more, like Romulo, for example, did. You know? But he was always like a ladies' man, too. That was his weak spot.
So
that guy, man, that was his weak spot.
So, Drake, you know? Coach's dream of having a world champion. That is their dream. And 99% of them never accomplish that.
Yes.
Do you understand like how special it is to have so many people with the name world champion that you've brought from blue belt forward?
Brother, it is something that I'm grateful every single day for it. It's something that makes me really proud. And something that I do not take for granted. But let me tell you the honest truth. All the world champions that I made, and several champions in several other stuff, Pan Americans, Nationals, and MMA champions, Abu Dhabi champions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was never my main goal. My main goal was to be the best jiu-jitsu professor that I could ever be. And to change people's lives for the best. I wanted to touch people's lives in a way that I would improve their life somehow for them to be better persons, like Jiu-Jitsu did to me. I was a really good competitor too. But what Jiu-Jitsu gave to me was way more than my medals, way more than my titles. Jiu-Jitsu built me in who I am. And I wanted to do exactly the same thing. If in this process, I could make world champions, awesome. I did it. And if I can do more, and I'm actually doing more, I have this girl now, Andressa Sintra, four-time conservative world champion. Yeah. So it's working so far still. But my main goal, man, is beyond that, brother, I'm telling you. You know, like what really turns me on is that I really have the notion that jiu-jitsu is a very powerful tool for us all to improve our life. I really believe this with all my heart. I think what we have is a blessing, you know? And maybe some will be champions. Most of them won't be champions, of course. Most of the people won't be. There's only one. Yeah. But, man, they all change their lives for the best. And then, you know, while God allows me to keep doing that, that's what I'm going to keep doing. That's my number one goal.
So our theory here on this podcast is that there's really only two types of coaches. There is your coach that brings somebody from white belt to black belt to, you know, different levels and world champion. And then there's poachers, the big game hunters that try to grab students and lure them over. And for fighters, both are necessary. Both of them. You have to have both if you want supreme excellence. You are a coach. You're not a big game hunter. Now, big game might come your way, but you're a coach. There's very few coaches, very many poachers, big game hunters.
You are. And man, like Mike, I'm so glad that you brought it over because almost nobody talks about it.
They're stupid.
You know, almost nobody talks about it. You are. I'm so glad that you're bringing that up. And I agree 1,000% of what you said. I think they're both necessary for the highest level. I think they're both realities that need to be in place. However, this is from my own experience, right? I mean, you know my coaching experience and my experience on this field. I've been both. Mostly I'm being a coach because 90% of my guys I bring up since they didn't know anything about nothing. I bring them up. Oh, I'm sorry. Because my battery is almost dying. But I brought them since kids until the top of the world. But I also got some really talented people that came to me because of my reputation.
Of course.
Already great. But I made them better. I could adjust them. This girl, Andressa Sintra, world champion, is a classical example. She was already like a natural beast. Crazy good. But with a lot of flaws, technical flaws on the game that I corrected. I did my best. Now she's unstoppable. Four-time consecutive world champion, man, shit. And nowadays, it's extremely hard. On the adults. It's not like the adults is the top of the food chain. I'm not talking about masters, talking about adults, black belts. So I can tell you from my heart, being a poacher is way easier than being a coach. Way easier.
Life is easy when you just collect a check. Yeah,
brother.
Not even a lot of students. Just let me have the checks. Yeah.
Yeah. You are. Yep. You know, it's way easier, brother. Way easier. And I'm not judging. I'm not pointing fingers. Not at all. I'm just saying what
you
it
are.
Is.
Bro. That's not what you are.
Exactly. I'm just saying what it is. I mean, the tough job is to get somebody who doesn't even know how to do a jumping jack and turn into a champion.
World champion.
That is the tough job. This job is tough. That's tough.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie to you. It's very tough.
So your battery's going to die. Won't we close with one more question? When people ask what kind of guy Draculino is, I've never met you, but I will say December 20th, 2010 is a very good example of what type of human being you are. You flew to Brazil to give Thiago Hoylarzino his black belt. Would you mind explaining to people the reason why and who he was to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Man, Thiago was a kid that I brought over to the U.S. on the previous 2 years. And we were like, he lived in my house for years. He was like my oldest son because I have my son, Igor, and my daughter, Jay. He he was living with us like part of a family. He was just a family member. And man, like, I remember that I used to give him a hard time because, I mean, people who I love, I bully them in a good way.
You have to.
If I love them, if I am always like this to you, maybe they'll like you too much. But if I bully you, I love you. Trust me.
Yes. Yes. Good. Yeah.
You know? So he used to snore like crazy. I remember that he used to live to sleep in a bedroom. I would listen to him snoring from my bedroom with both doors closed. And in the morning, I was like, motherfucker, man, like, you're like the loudest snorer guy that I've ever met in my life. And then giving him a hard time. And then all of a sudden started to bed really bad. And I was like, man, you know, let's go to a doctor. Let's check on this. I mean, this is not right. I mean, I know people snore, but your snore is like out of this world. But I didn't think much about it. I thought, you know, you never thought about. And then, man, like, he went to Brazil to renew his work visa. The visa was approved, everything. I paid for it and everything. He called me. I was here in America. He called me and said, like, hey, Master, man, I need to talk to you about something. Like, they found something strange on my nose and my throat. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, like, I don't know. They have to do some tests. I was like, okay, all right. 2 days later, he was already doing chemo. He was just a monster cancer that was from inside here, the nose area, all the way through the sinus area, throat, everything. It was just like something monstrous. It was just a tumor that was
advanced. Yeah.
Huge. And then, man, he went to treatment right away. And I talked to a doctor of ours. He's a black belt under me. His name is Rodrigo. I called him and I say, man, like, what is going on? What do you think? He goes like, hey, Master, I went there. I talked to the doctors. He's not going to make it. I said, like, what? He said, yeah, he's not going to make it. I believe in miracles, but I don't think at this point he's not going to make it. And he was about to get the black belt with me.
Oh,
fuck. And I was like, fuck, man. I mean, I did not hesitate. Me, my whole family, not just me and my wife, my kids, we took a plane, went to Brazil. Every day that I was in Brazil, I visited him. He was already in very terrible shape. He was with tracheostomy. Yeah. He was already with something.
It was trach, yeah.
And he was doing like a massive amount of like chemo and radiotherapy, but the thing would like get a little smaller. And when they stopped because they couldn't keep giving the medicine or as he would die, it was too much medicine, the thing would double the size. It was just monstrous. It was crazy. And then I went there. And I gave him the black belt. That's this picture that he was in the hospital with the shirt and he has a black belt. And I remember that me and him and my wife, we cried like, man, it was like one of the most emotional moments of my life. He was crying, but he was crying of joy. That was a good thing. He wasn't crying like feeling like pity of himself or anything. It's joy, pure joy. And I remember that the last thing I told him, this was on a Thursday night. The last thing I told him was, look, I'm playing with him. Hey, you dumbass. I'm not giving you this out of pity. I'm giving you that because you are a black belt, a real one, and one of the best I ever had. Never forget that. He said, he couldn't speak because of the thing. He said, like, kind of like, I know. He said, I know. We hug each other. I left. Friday night, I got a call from his girlfriend and she said, the things are not looking great. So I said, okay, I'll be there in the morning. And he passed away during the night. You know, so pretty much maybe 36 hours after I gave him the black belt, he passed away. You know, so it was like,
you did the right thing. That's what you
did.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that that well-deserved belt, again, I did not, I swear to God, Seriously, because a lot of people think I did this out of pity. It wasn't.
Nothing to prove to anybody.
Yes, he wasn't the case, bro. He wasn't the case. He was a good black belt that deserved that belt more than anyone. I was just blessed by God to have time to do that, because he's a black belt in heaven now. He's a real black belt in heaven that is training with a lot of other black belts of mine that left this earth. 2 years ago, I had two that actually committed suicide in Brazil.
Yeah.
It's been a tough time lately. But man, that was the story behind Thiago. God bless his soul.
I will tell you, I read the story. I went down a deep rabbit hole. One of the most emotional things I've ever read.
Yeah. And it was really tough. I remember my kids were younger and my kids were really crying a lot. Like, they're starting to really understand death. When people close to them, family, living together, they really felt for the first time, I think, like, man, this thing is real, you know? And it was very sad. But man, at the same time, I believe that God does the right thing. We don't understand. Our human ignorance is huge. We are ignorant. But at the end of the day, it was his time. So I really believe
paths.
That.
No, you crossed paths. You made a difference in each of your lives, not just his, yours as well. Yeah.
Man, I'm so glad you brought him up, man. I mean, like, we need to talk about this guy more because he deserves.
Yeah, here, and you're leaving Pablo Silva, Eric Wanderlei, Claudio Matos, Roberto Sanchez, Alex Moreno, Juliana Lima. All of these people fought at incredibly high levels. And there's so many more, and we never even got a chance to talk to them. That is just how deep you go with jiu-jitsu and how many lives
you brother.
Thank you, brother. Absolute pleasure. When we meet, I will be requesting a picture with you, sir.
For sure. My pleasure too, brother. And look, there was the best interview I've done in a long time. I'm not doing this to leak ass because I don't need to leak ass. But I'm telling you the truth. It was incredible. You did an amazing research first. And you asked questions such as the poaching versus coaching. And also about Thiago and about also like a lot of other things that are great, man. I had a great time. Let me see. How what time is it?
2 hours.
2 hours. It felt like 2 minutes.
Draculino, you're an absolute. Honestly, man, I admire you as a person, and I sincerely appreciate you coming out. Thank you, sir.
Same here, my brother. I appreciate it. Let me know when it comes out. All right.
I'm going to tag you in it. Don't worry, sir. Take care.
Thank you, my brother. Have a good night.
Fantastic interview with Draculino, a legend within the sport of jiu-jitsu with incredible family heritage in regards to the early days of the Gracies. This guy right here, Jay Mather. Jay, you're out of Houston, Texas. You're the one that hooked us up with it. Why don't you tell everybody how this interview came about?
Hey, everyone. So I'm a huge fan of this podcast. I think it's doing a great service documenting history of MMA. I think the dark years are really unfortunate that they happened due to lawmakers. So I think it's important for all of us to get on the internet and watch all these fights chronologically and start document, like they're documenting the past on this show. So I'm a huge fan and reached out to Mike. And we spoke about people in Houston who are, you know, martial arts legends. And I had to bring up Draculino.
Yeah.
I started training jiu-jitsu about 10 years ago. And I train out of Houston at Gracie Baja West Chase. And I've gotten to go train, drive over to Draculino's though, which is about 45 minutes away. And the instruction there from all the instructors, in particular Professor Draculino, is extremely impressive. And I've gotten to hear a lot of awesome stories about him. He's incredibly knowledgeable about jiu-jitsu and MMA. And he has a reputation for being very honest.
And he's like a very desired interview and does these a lot. So because I think he manages like 60 Gracie Bajas and has 3 gyms of his own. So due to that fact, he's got very limited time. And the amount of real estate that we got with him was only due, in fact, because of your relationship with him. So that's why we got this much time. I mean, it's very, very important for me to acknowledge that, because we could not have pulled this off without you. So it's a greatly appreciated, Jay.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Okay. So when this thing kind of comes about, like interviews come about, in essence, what takes place is I need about 8 to 10 hours of research for every hour that we talk on the LOP. Like, I'm not just like opening up a Wikipedia page. Like, if you're this far into the interview, you obviously know that. Mm-hmm. A lot of the facts and stuff like that kind of come about in our interviews is because I'm chasing down different people from different scenes that I've ran into in my almost 30 years within the sport of mixed martial arts, you know, behind the scenes, and getting this type of inside information. So when Draculino, when you kind of laid it on thick in regards to, hey, Draculino, these guys need to interview you, it kind of put him in a position where he had to say yes, but not for like how much time. And he gave us 24 hours to figure this out. So we did 2 hours with him, which absolutely equates to 16 to 20 hours of research. So with Jay, I was emailing him, look at Vitor Belfort in Europe, look at Ian Gracie. And you were watching, I couldn't watch the fights because we didn't have enough time for me tracking other people down and taking notes on the fight. So Jay, like watching those fights, did it kind of bring you back a little bit?
Yeah, it was great. It was great seeing, you know, I'd seen Vitor was the fighter that made me love MMA in the first place. Seeing him fight like Vanderlei Silva, Tank Abbott, you know, he looks like a complete badass. So as a kid, you know, you think that's pretty great. And so I saw him fight. I can't remember who he fought in that fight, but it was classic Vitor with finish, and Professor Draculino was in it. But the one I really
the Anthony Ray fight. Yes.
Andy Ray. Thank you.
Ray. Yep.
Yeah. And that guy put up a good fight. I was surprised. I'm looking forward to watching more. Was that Cage Rage?
Yes. So that's the organization where one of the promoters, I don't have his name in front of me, he and Ian Freeman kind of do their like in between fight hype. And one of them, it looks like he just did like a giant rail of cocaine, and he uses like Ian Freeman at his like his personal jungle gym. And Ian's just sitting there like, man, I'm getting paid for this, but holy shit. You know, it's like some ADHD coked out dude that, you know, is one of the promoters. So just so everybody knows, like Draculino in the interview, like how he answered it was very politically correct. He had no problems with them, but with Vitor, but he had heard there was issues. So I kind of cut the red tape on that, because in essence, if you listen to our Pat Miletich interview, at one point at a UFC, they had to pull Pat Miletich into his dressing room to convince Vitor to walk to the cage. Like, that's how, like, you know, anxious Vitor Belfort gets. So he didn't give us any stories because he wasn't there, but Draculino had heard about him.
Yeah, on that point, I've heard that too. But to me, it's like you're about to go fight a really scary person in a fight with not a lot of rules. So I think it's only natural to be afraid, you know, and different people handle stress differently. So, I mean, more power to him for going out and doing that for not a
sure
than not doing it at all.
Well, dude, it's Vitor Belfort. What are you going to do? Hey, Vitor, you got no heart? You're scared?
yeah, exactly. Please. So, his record stands for itself, you know.
100%, absolute legend. So in the interview, kind of emotional at the end. I'm glad I got the Carlson Gracie stuff out of the interview. And I just finished Anthony Pettis Fighting Championship, APFC number 4. It's up on Fight Pass. I got Carlson Gracie a plug, dude, as I always do.
Yeah, as he should. Professor Carlson, I'll try and not kill everyone to death with the formalities of calling black belts professor, but he deserves more credit than he gets. I mean, his students are incredible. You know, Vitor, Murilo Bustamante,
Sperry,
Alan Goez,
Mario Sperry. Yeah.
Yeah, it goes on forever and ever. And they were going hard in both MMA and sports jiu-jitsu. And the Gracie Baja team, you know, through Professor Carlinhos, you know, Henzo, Half High-End, they were all Gracie Baja at the time. And just the Machado brothers were all training with Carlinhos too. So, I mean, it's actually a very tight-knit group of people, but they produced so many complete badasses.
So, you know, there are a couple questions that we missed on. Mm-hmm. Pentagon Combat, the riot with Henzo. I know Draculino was there, but we had such little time to prepare that those little cornermen stories, dude, I couldn't get them all because I needed the jiu-jitsu history as well as like where he fit in. And we did every bit of 2 hours. So at some point, I think I got my brown belt. Brown belt is an interviewer from Draculino. Mm-hmm. Refused to give me the black belt at the end, but said it was, you know, good experience. So I think what we do is, you know, between yourself and myself, when we have got a little bit more preparation and more rapport, we come up with about 20 more, you know, Gracie / you know, cornerman type questions. And I guarantee we can get another fascinating 2 hours out of him.
Yeah. That was part of the reason I didn't want to be on it while y'all were interviewing him. I was like, nobody wants to hear what Jay has to say on it. They want to hear what Draculino has to say on the matter. And yeah, it's great. I particularly loved him talking about Gracie Fusion with High and Gracie,
yeah,
as well as, you know, of course, Half and Henzo as well. But
wait, describe High and Gracie to everybody.
Oh, it is just 100% aggression. I absolutely love him now that I've watched his fights because I was looking for Professor Draculino, but he wasn't in it. But I still saw them anyways. I was like, he's training partners and like best friends with this guy anyway, so maybe they'll want to talk about it. And he, before the fight, these are Vanderlei Silva level stare downs. He just looks like he wants to rip the people apart.
Eat their soul. So there's a famous story that I will get to, mm-hmm, hopefully if I ever get Henzo, where Henzo and Hyun were driving to the airport. And they had to stop the car 3 different times in order to fist fight on the side of the road, then get back into the car and continue on to the airport. I think it was before one of Hyun's Japanese. It may have been right before his Sakuraba fight.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all based on the lore of those three, you know. It just in Brazil in general, a lot of people don't know that there's some pretty rough history of jiu-jitsu in Brazil. And, of course, like these legends don't want to, you know, spill too much tea and make each other look bad. But yeah, I mean, these guys were throwing down. The dojo storming thing wasn't like some lighthearted affair. They're going and like instigating these fights at these schools, gyms, be like, we dare you to beat us. And they usually won.
Right. And like Draculino didn't skirt away from that. He said it was kind of like gang activity.
No. Yeah. So, yeah, he wasn't in the Gracie and action tapes that are obviously so badass. But
I figured, you know, that question that I asked about the Gracie challenge, I figured there was probably more instances when things like this took place, and not mm-hmm. every single time would they ever have a video camera there. So that's what kind of, you know, allowed me an entry there for that question.
That challenge was popular for quite some time, and I'm pretty sure it still stands. Like most gyms, if some random dude comes in offering to fight, like if they can't get, you know, convince them otherwise, they're probably going to do it. And, you know, these guys should know a little better because they get freaking hurt doing it, you know?
Right.
But I think that stuff is super interesting. And a lot of, you know, unless you go burying around on MMA forums looking for the information, a lot of that's not out there. And it's, you know, I'm really happy that that's not as popular anymore. Like, you know, the beach fights and like just getting in fights in the streets, basically. I'm glad that's not as popular anymore because keep that shit in the mat and in the cage, you know, like settle it there. And, you know, cause people get really hurt doing that. And but I think it's super interesting. So we should discourage it while also knowing like these guys were not, rolling light. Like you hear in jiu-jitsu, like we were flow rolling. They were not flow rolling. They were trying to defend something they believed in. It was awesome.
Well, we're going to get Draculino on again, you know, once we get our questions lined up. Pentagon Combat's going to come up. And I got to tell you, like, he's never been asked about the Hugo Duarte fight, and well, he wasn't in the country. But you know, it's just kind of like, well, why wasn't he asked? I mean, he was he literally grew up next to them. You know, like he, you know, Helf was his neighbor.
It was a talented room when you hear about everyone that he's trained with. And you look at the people that have formed MMA gyms, like there isn't like a massive Gracie Baja MMA team. Like, you know, we discussed earlier, it was mostly a sports jiu-jitsu school, but they've had people train out of there that like, you know, who is the coach out of, Professor Tusa out of, you know, Albuquerque with Greg Jackson's gym. You know, he's given a bunch of black belts to these guys. At American Kickboxing with Dave Camarillo, great. You know, he was a Henzo Gracie guy. So a lot of these gyms. Oh, Amal Easton trained heavily at Gracie Baja in Colorado. Yeah. You know how many beasts there are in Colorado at the moment.
So, I mean, just so everybody knows, like I travel a lot and I go to these gyms and I physically talk to the people in there. And I've been in Colorado, I think, 3 times within the last 6 months. There is no number one like Denver, Colorado, in terms of MMA cities. Like, of course, you got Albuquerque, you've got Florida, especially like Miami. I mean, look at it. You've got, you know, Cliff Kill and, you know, obviously American Top Team, amongst many, many others. And it doesn't even compare. It's not even a close second to what's happening in Denver, Colorado. You know, in Amal Easton, he's got 9 giant gyms.
Yeah, I know.
In Denver, all of them successful.
They're really successful right now with like Justin Gaethje, Kamaru Usman.
I would not Dwayne Ludwig does not have a fight gym. He's got like a get in shape gym. I've been there twice, like I said, twice in the last 6 months, just his gym in particular. There's oftentimes not enough space for his students to work out in. And all of them look fight ready. Like Steve Poprocky, he's a guy, DCO MMA. He's one of the smaller gyms there. The guy's cornered people in world title fights. Like, dude, there's no close second to Denver, Colorado. And Gracie Baja has a staple there with Amal Easton, and Draculino gave him the start. So anyway, Jay, I'm thanking you so much, man. Like, you dropped all your social life to help me review the fights and kind of go through notes with me. It's greatly appreciated, man. And this would not have happened without your help.
No, the pleasure's all mine. Everybody, go watch the old fights. You'll be glad you did.
Thanks, guys. Like, share, subscribe. Leave us a review on iTunes. If you guys comment on YouTube, it really helps us out. You know, I think we're going to get a bunch of new viewers, you know, from Gracie Baja with this. And, man, I'm really proud of it. We've also got other jiu-jitsu interviews. Francisco Bueno. We've got like 3 or 4 different Pedro Sauer.
Alberto Crane.
Like, we've got some pretty serious stuff happening on the jiu-jitsu side. So if you like this in-depth look, you know, maybe not into the MMA thing, go check out the other jiu-jitsu guys we're doing. And I'm working on Alan Goez right now. I've communicated with him, getting him to commit. Yeah, I'm going to try to get Shembri as well. I might need you to contact Mr. Draculino for us about maybe shooting them a text.
I mean, I hope they say yes, because their fights are badass.
Yeah. Shembri standing over a Sakuraba, and Sakuraba never got the rematch. He might not have wanted it. That's like the one guy that might not have wanted it. Meanwhile, Sakuraba continues to go through the Gracie family. Like, dude, that's some legendary stuff right there. But Jay, thank you. I hope you guys enjoyed this as much as we did. Appreciate it, buddy.
Great. Take care, y'all.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.